So we're going to start with the opening of Luke's gospel. Luke, not quite the opening, but the opening of the nativity story that Charlie Brown read on the television. In those days, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be registered. It's a very interesting way to begin the account of Jesus' life. Luke, I think, is showing that there's something very significant going on. There's a new king, Caesar Augustus, who for the first time had the ability to exercise world dominion. This registration of all the peoples in the empire is a very significant moment in his administrative power. And at that very moment, a new king was born in an obscure province of the empire, a king whose claims and challenge would be one day very evident to those who ruled Rome. Rome had a term called the oikumene, which is the known world, the civilized world, we would probably say. And that's the term in Luke 2, that all the world should be registered. It's the oikumene, the Roman world, the world of civilization, the world that matters, basically. Later in the Gospels, Rome will keep learning about this new king. Pontius Pilate found out that the king's reign was not of this world in John 18:36. That could sound to some people like Jesus' kingdom is irrelevant to earthly powers like Rome, but actually that's just clearly not true, because the king, King Jesus and his kingdom keep confronting Rome in different ways. I think the right way to understand Jesus' statement there is that his kingdom is greater than Rome or any earthly power. It's not supported by mere earthly political strength, but by heavenly and spiritual strength. After Roman soldiers crucified Jesus, he rose again. They treated him like a slave, but he came back like a king, sending ambassadors all around the world announcing his reign, and those are the apostles. In the book of Acts, constantly Roman magistrates are being bewildered by the apostles and their ministry. They don't know what to do. They don't seem to have committed any horrible crime. They're starting all these riots. The Jews are not happy. The Jews are always an element in the Roman Empire at that time that were unstable politically. And there was always these concerns of rebellions and so on. So anybody causing trouble among the Jews is going to be concerning to any Roman emperor. In the year 110, we have a letter from a governor named Pliny the Younger. And he wrote to the Emperor Trajan. And he said, I need advice about how to handle the Christians. And basically, in the course of asking advice, he tells Trajan what he'd been doing, and he's sort of asking, he's basically bouncing some ideas off the Emperor Trajan. That's probably too informal a way to put it, but it's something like that. And he basically says, Christianity seems like some exotic superstition, and it also seems concerning because it might be a dangerous political association. So I decided to torture a few of them, see if they would confess. And then after that, I decided to make them all offer sacrifice to the emperor. And any who didn't, I figured they're stubborn and they're no good, so I executed them. And that's Pliny the Younger's rather unsophisticated approach to this. He just figured, let's get rid of the troublemakers. He said, I had no doubt, whatever the nature of their creed, their stubbornness and inflexible obstinacy surely deserve to be punished. And it's interesting, sacrifice was the test that Pliny implemented. Are they going to offer sacrifice to the emperor or are they not? That was the kind of the up or down question. He didn't really care. Like, for instance, he didn't ask them what they thought about creation. He didn't ask them what they thought about, you know, different gods. What's your view on Zeus? Nothing like that. None of that mattered. It was just, will you offer sacrifice to the emperor? And that leads us to think about sacrifice. And this is really important for understanding how things went down between Christianity and Rome. Sacrifices were really important in Rome. One of the emperor's titles was Pontifex Maximus, high priest. That title is still, if you go on Twitter and you type in Pontifex, you get the Pope's Twitter account. That's the ancient Roman title for the emperor in his religious duties. He was the guardian and the leader of Roman sacrifices. And that meant sacrifice was always closely associated with high political office. They were always very significant public acts. It wasn't just a sort of private matter. It was the emperor's job to make sure the sacrifices were right. Sacrifice was also very important in the military. Before a battle, the priests would offer sacrifice to seek the god's help. You know that term augur? It doesn't augur well. Have you ever heard that term? That comes from these sacrifices, because what they would do is they would like open up a chicken and they spill the guts on the ground. It's kind of gross. And then the priests would like look at the chicken guts and see, yes, it seems like a good time to launch into battle. So reading the tea leaves is a much more civilized English thing to do. Reading the chicken guts was sort of the Roman way to do it. So anybody in the military had to be very comfortable with sacrifices like this. Otherwise, you'd run into problems. Now, the Jews stood out in this whole system because they wouldn't participate in Roman or Greek sacrifices because they had their own god with his own sacrifices at the temple, and that was the only place that they would offer sacrifice. But actually, even though they were different from the rest of the population, their way of doing things actually fit in pretty well. If you think about it, the Roman Empire didn't force everybody to have the same god with the same sacrifice, but they did want everybody to have their own sacrifice to their own god in their own place, done their own way, so that culture, politics, religion, it would all kind of work out together under this larger system of the empire's leadership. And so, as long as the Jews didn't rebel, the Romans weren't too bothered, you know, if the Macedonians have their way of offering sacrifice and the Jews have their way, it's okay. It didn't stress them out too badly. What really didn't fit into the empire was the Christian way of offering sacrifice, which was not to do it at all. That was a very surprising thing. So much so that the Christians were charged with being atheists. So, you know, think about that next time someone says we're too religious. You can just tell people, actually, they used to say we weren't nearly religious enough. That was the original charge against Christians. The other thing that was really troubling in the Roman Empire was that Christians crossed all the ethnic boundaries. So the Jews, you had to be Jewish or sort of willing to become either very adjacent to Judaism or actually become Jewish yourself in order to share in that whole system of Jewish sacrifice. But the Christians, they had people converting from all sorts of different places and cultures and languages and people groups, and they didn't require them to change ethnicity. They just said, now, where you are, in your culture, in your language, serve the Lord Jesus Christ, who's risen from the dead. That was a very novel thing, and it disrupted this connection between culture, politics, and ethnicity, and sacrifice. And that's, I think, why Pliny was saying things like, you know, it seems like a very dangerous political association. What other agenda could they possibly have if it's not a traditional ethnic religion? Maybe they're trying to overtake the empire, which was the one institution that transcended these ethnic boundaries. So Christianity looked very threatening precisely for that reason. Now, we're pretty familiar with the idea that in the early centuries, Christians were persecuted. But it's actually good to know, persecution was not constant, far from it. It was somewhat sporadic, and at times, in certain places, it was quite severe. But generally speaking, it wasn't like there was a blanket policy of persecution at all times in all places. There's two significant moments at which persecution flared up, significant for our study today. One is in the middle of the 3rd century, approximately the year 250. There was an emperor named Decius who required that everyone sacrifice to Jupiter and started kind of enforcing this policy much more strictly. At that time, many church leaders were forced to flee, and many Christians suffered bravely. Others caved to the pressure and offered sacrifice against their conscience or turned over copies of the Bible, things like this, that were ways of escaping the persecution. Then, shortly after that, in the middle of the 3rd century, there was a massive crisis unfolding in the empire, and it's really a brutal period for the empire. Disease, poor weather, food shortages, shrinking population, growing populations outside the empire that are moving into the empire across the borders, destabilizing society, military defeats on the Persian frontier, and a series of emperors dying untimely deaths by assassination or military disaster. Really, it's a brutal period. Compared to the age of Augustus, when Caesar Augustus ruled for something like 50 years, and there was growth and stability. The middle of the third century was just a terrible time. And during that time, while the empire was weakening, the Christian population was growing dramatically. And those two trends converged around a guy named Diocletian, who I shared a little bit about a couple weeks ago. He became emperor in the late 3rd century, and he was a very smart guy, and he devoted his abilities to solving the crisis of the 3rd century. He did a whole bunch of things. He appointed 3 other co-emperors to share the work of governing the empire, so now there's 4 emperors, 2 in the east, 2 in the west, sort of a senior and a junior in each place, basically. He reorganized the empire's management and finances, and he also made it a priority to restore traditional piety. So he thought the whole crisis of the 3rd century had at its root the failure to worship the old gods. That was the problem. And his solution was to be very diligent in restoring the worship of the old gods, and that meant he was very concerned about this growing population of Christians who rejected those sacrifices because they thought they were demonic. So at the start of the 4th century, Diocletian launched the worst persecution that the Romans ever brought against the Christians. He banned worship services, arrested clergy, he required everyone to offer sacrifices to the gods and to the emperor. All around the empire this happened, but some places were worse than others, and things were really bad. There's records of Christians being torn to pieces, roasted alive in fire, having an eye gouged out and a leg maimed with a branding iron. And those are just a few examples of some of the things that were done to Christians in order to enforce this policy. Things continued like that for several years. There's a lot of details, but basically 5 to 8 years under Diocletian and the next emperor, Galerius, in the early years of the 4th century. And at the same time, you know, no doubt Christians were praying for deliverance, and looking back, we can see that God was providing an answer. The answer was this man, Constantine. Now, Constantine was a young soldier at the turn of the 4th century when Diocletian was unleashing this persecution. Constantine worked at Diocletian's court. He was a government official, military leader. Constantine's father was a man named Constantius. It's very confusing because everybody in Constantine's family has like the same name. It'd be like me having a son named Calvinian and my dad being Calvinius, and it's just really confusing. But anyways, his father was Constantius. Constantius was one of the 4 emperors that worked alongside Diocletian, and he was responsible for the extreme west. So France and Britain was Constantius's domain. Constantine joined his father on campaign in northern England in the year 306, and during that campaign, his father unexpectedly died. And the army immediately hailed Constantine as their next emperor. This is actually a pretty common way for people to become emperors. The army basically picked them. And the good thing about this was Constantius himself and now Constantine, they were both quite different from Diocletian in their attitude to Christians. They didn't support the persecution. And so that was already a good sign. But this was a very volatile moment in Roman politics. The whole system of 4 co-emperors, as you could imagine, I mean, it wasn't holding together very well. It's pretty unstable. And almost immediately, Constantine was at war with the other Western emperor, a guy named Maxentius. And those two emperors and their armies met at a famous battle called the Battle of the Milvian Bridge in the year 312. Now, it's significant because Roman soldiers in these battles, as I said, were accustomed to military banners honoring the gods, sacrifices before the battle, things like that. And Maxentius's armies did all that. What was unusual was Constantine's armies saw something different happening. There were no sacrifices, the prayers had been changed, and there were new banners marked with the symbol based on Christ's name. It's the hero symbol, which is like an X with a sort of R. It looks like a P, but in Greek it's R. So it's the first two letters of Christ's name. That's what was on the banner. And now Constantine won the battle and assumed leadership of the Western Empire and immediately ended the persecution of Christians in his domain. And then, together with the Eastern Emperor, a guy named Licinius, who was Constantine's his brother-in-law, those two together issued the Edict of Milan in the year 313, which provided toleration for Christians in the empire. Just by the way, they didn't make Christianity the official religion of the empire, they merely provided for tolerating Christians. That's a significant detail that sometimes people miss. Licinius and Constantine shared the rule of the empire until the year 325. Their alliance didn't last long, though, and civil war erupted between them in the year 316. And for that decade in between, Constantine and Licinius had very different policies towards the church. Licinius basically went back to the norm, sort of generally negative attitude to the church with occasional persecution, though not as bad as what happened under Diocletian. And Constantine, well, he supported the church, and he did lots of things to make life a little easier for Christians. And so the East and the West were experiencing different things during that decade. But here's the question. Why was there this change? You know, why did things change so suddenly? We have to rely on evidence from Constantine's biographers here. The most famous of those biographers is a guy named Eusebius of Caesarea. We'll meet him later because he became a leading supporter of Arius, but he was a very prominent church leader. And as part of his prominence, he was the official biographer of the Emperor Constantine. And basically, piecing things together, Constantine must, it seems that he had two significant religious experiences that prompted him to convert to Christ. There's a really good book that I'm basically just summarizing here. It's Peter Leithart's book called Defending Constantine. So nothing in here is really original. I'm just going to cite him now. I don't have to cite him every other sentence. But it's pretty much his interpretation that I'm sharing with you now. The first of those experiences happened in the year 310. Constantine and his soldiers saw some kind of vision. They described it as something like a double halo around the sun with beams of light forming a cross in it. And it was a public vision. It was something not only Constantine saw. And the second was the night before the battle at Milvian Bridge, and Constantine reports hearing from God, "By this sign you will conquer." And the sign was the cross, or that Kyro symbol. And that's pretty patchy evidence. It's probably true that Constantine knew about Christianity in more ways than just those two visions, but we can't be totally sure. Whatever happened, it's significant that the outcome was that Constantine did convert. He did start doing things differently. You know, he changed the prayers, he changed the banners, he changed the sacrifices, he changed his policy. It wasn't like he was faking it in the long run. Those visions, it's always hard to evaluate when we hear reports of visions and things. It's always a little hard to evaluate, and there's a tendency to be very skeptical. There's also a tendency to be very skeptical of Constantine and everything about him, especially modern historians are just really, really skeptical of him. We'll get to that in a minute, but if we piece it together, it just seems like that he had these two experiences, and then the outward fruit of it was these public changes that everybody could see. Now, Constantine, quite naturally, was pretty concerned for the church immediately. He became involved in the church's problems. And one of the problems of that time was the Donatist controversy. The Donatist controversy was a dispute about how to treat Christians who had capitulated to persecution back in the day. And this was happening in North Africa. Donatus was a church leader who said that the people who had capitulated, like turning over scriptures or offering incense to the emperor against their conscience, they could never again serve as priests. Their baptisms were invalid. You know, they're just totally, they're totally done. And they were opposed by the other bishops. And then the whole matter came to Constantine, and he appointed the Bishop of Rome to lead a tribunal to hear their case. The tribunal ruled against the Donatists, and so they appealed to Constantine again, and he called another council in France, and that council also ruled against the Donatists, and still the Donatists wouldn't agree. So then Constantine sent in the army and tried to solve it that way, and it really didn't work. And basically, that was the only time Constantine ever tried to solve anything with the army, because he soon realized it's just not going to work. And I share that bit about the Donatist controversy because it provided a template for what happened in the Arian crisis at the Nicene Council. In other words, in just a few years, Constantine had some experience. Oh, this church, it seems like they're unified, but there's actually conflict. And he had some practice at playing this role of appointing a council. He didn't try to solve it himself as if he were a theologian, but he did convene the meetings at which church leaders solved the problem. And then he did get this practical experience of, it doesn't really work to send in the army. So that all happened in the years before the Nicene Council. Now, we need to talk about what to make of Constantine. And this is really just the last thing that we'll do. We won't advance the narrative any further, but we want to talk about whether we like Constantine or not. This is a big question. I'll share with you the general answer in the modern church is no, we don't like Constantine. The general answer in the hundreds and hundreds of years before the modern church was yes, of course we like Constantine. And I personally used to think, no, I don't like Constantine. And partly by studying the Nicene Council in the 4th century, I've come around. I think Constantine's a great guy, just laying my cards out on the table. And I'm going to try and justify my appreciation for Constantine now. So here's one criticism of him. He's a hypocrite. That's one of the criticisms. Lots of historians and theologians, especially since the Enlightenment, have been very skeptical about Constantine's conversion. They have theories. You know, he converted to gain the church's political support. It would be really nice if all these Christians could support me and vote for me and help me out. It's true, too, that Constantine's personal conduct was not always blameless. There's one especially tragic episode where his wife and his son, who were to each other stepmother and stepson, they weren't blood relatives, they had an affair with each other, and Constantine had them executed. So that's a particularly notable, controversial episode. Did he do the right thing, or was he overly harsh? So that's an example of areas where Constantine's personal conduct was certainly not above criticism. I would say it's always difficult to give a fair evaluation of an ancient political and military leader. They often faced pretty tough choices, and the evidence that we have is always very sketchy. So you always have to think, who's reporting this, and what motive would they have for reporting it in a certain way? And in the 20th century, we still have lots of evidence to sort through things like that. In the 4th century, we might have like 3 pieces of evidence, and that's all you've got. So there's a lot of guesswork going on in some of these interpretations, and I think we should be somewhat cautious. In general, healthy skepticism about politicians is always a good idea. Like, that's perfectly reasonable. And it's true that Constantine was not motivated purely by theology or personal godliness or something like that. There was a lot going on in Constantine's life, and so we should be realistic about that. On the other hand, I don't think it would be totally fair to write him off as a total hypocrite. He did effect an enormous change in Roman public life. I mean, he ended the old sacrifices. He ended thousands of years of religious tradition that were evil. He ended the persecution of Christians. He introduced many legal reforms to protect the poor, vulnerable children, slaves. He funded new church buildings, afforded protections to Christian clergy, and one really crucial thing was he recognized the jurisdiction of church courts. And you might think, why does that matter? And one reason is because the Roman court system was very dysfunctional, especially if you didn't have a lot of money. You know, sound familiar? If you were a poor person, the Roman courts were just so complicated that essentially there was no way you were going to be able to get justice there. But church courts were different. They were much more immediately available to normal people. And for settling relatively small and simple disputes, they were a very good setting for solving day-to-day problems. And Constantine recognized those courts, which was a huge blessing to many people. And under Constantine's leadership, crucifixion was banned. It was still a practice at that time to crucify slaves. And branding was banned as a punishment. So I think if you met a politician who'd accomplished that, you know, if we lived in a country where people were being crucified, branded, where there was persecution of the church, where the legal system was really oppressive, and somebody came along and fixed all that, I mean, we might have questions about whether he should have done this or that, or his personal life was totally blameless, but we might have to say in the grand scheme of things, nice. So basically, I think at least that level of appreciation for Constantine is warranted, because he did do a lot of things that were very good. Another criticism of him is that he's the reason there's a lot of compromise in the church. The basic premise of this way of thinking is that power corrupts, right? Anyone who has power is corrupt. And, you know, I didn't plan to say this, but basically I'll just point out, if that's true, who's the most corrupt person in the world is God, right, and Jesus. It can't be true totally that power corrupts. Otherwise God would be corrupt, okay? So power corrupts might be a true sort of statement about life in a fallen world under certain circumstances, but it can't be an absolutely true philosophical statement that applies to all of reality. I will say many modern Protestants fall into this mentality. They're very suspicious of everything after Constantine, and they think of the Reformation as kind of the bright light shining again after the Dark Ages began under Constantine. So 1300 years from Constantine to Luther, ugh, man, wish we could have skipped those 1300 years and get back to the pre-Constantinian period. I don't think that's a very good understanding of the Reformation, partly because the reformers themselves did not think this way. For instance, Matthew Henry, in his commentary on Revelation, says that Constantine's triumph over idolatry fulfilled various prophecies of Scripture. Now, whether Matthew Henry's right in those exegetical comments, my point is just that he wasn't negative about Constantine. And if we want to be faithful to the reformers, we shouldn't assume negativity to Constantine as part of that. Another thing is that the reformers did not call for a complete separation of church and state. Today it's common to hear, oh yeah, you know, the emperor had no business calling a council for the church because the emperor is involved in the state and the church should call councils. One problem with this is that we have in our hymnals the Westminster Confession. And do you know who called the Westminster Assembly?
The Parliament.
The Parliament, right. The government, in other words, right? And do you know who called the Synod of Dort? The assembly, the sort of equivalent assembly in the Netherlands? Again, it was the Dutch government. So if it's totally true that anything the government does to call a council, well, basically, kids, you should quit learning the Westminster Shorter Catechism. Maybe you'd be glad you're relieved of that duty. Okay, but in other words, basically, being Protestant does not mean that we believe the government has no positive role in religion. There's a lot to debate there, a lot to discuss there, but at the very least, in our own history, the English Parliament called the meeting that gave us our own Westminster standards. So we need to kind of just recognize that that's part of our life too. And Constantine's not a total anomaly in this larger pattern. He fits into this pattern pretty well. Another thing that comes to mind when people say Constantine was a compromiser is, well, what did you want him to do? What was he supposed to do? He converted to Christ and in the unique position of being the emperor of a mighty kingdom that was opposed to God and promoting the worship of false gods, persecuting Christians, and committing all sorts of other evil. What should he have done? Should he have quit? Should he have, you know, what do people want him to do? So sometimes I think the accusation of compromise is just a little bit unfair. Like, you got to start somewhere, right? Wouldn't it be nice to start with ending the persecution, promoting the unity of the church, changing various social problems and addressing them to be more righteous? I mean, he didn't accomplish everything, but who among us can accomplish everything that we need to do? Another thing that's important to notice about this compromise point, one of the ideas is that Constantine brought so much power and money to the church that the church got fat and lazy real quick, and they didn't have that old fire that they had under persecution. And I, again, think that's just a little bit unfair. Like, which of us think, do you think your Christian life would be a lot better if the government was camped outside watching whether we would worship? I mean, would that improve your Christian life? Would it help you pray? I mean, maybe, but it would also introduce problems. It would be harder to pastor people. It would be harder to preach. It would be harder to evangelize. You know, it could help or it could hurt, and we would need to trust God's blessing in any case. But some of the people that I know of or know personally whose churches have been disrupted by persecution, they report that the churches have a lot of spiritual problems, partly because it's so difficult to minister to people effectively in that context. It's hard to get people the pastoral counsel that they need. For instance, it's hard to get regular attendance at worship. So I don't think we should totally idealize the days of persecution as the days of purity. And we shouldn't think that Constantine made things too easy. All he did was remove the legal restrictions against Christianity so that all the different religions in the empire were relatively equal in the eyes of the law. So, I mean, if people are opposed to that, then we could talk more, but I don't think we should be totally unrealistic in this idea that Constantine just turned everybody into pumpkins in the 4th century. They used to be real fiery Christians, and then they were like fat, lazy, rich people after that. I don't think it was that big of a change. spiritually fat, lazy, rich people is what I'm getting at. So that's compromise. A third one is this problem of intolerance. And this is a big one today among, I would say, progressive Christians, like basically people who say they're Christians, but they're actually progressives. What they say is that before Constantine, the church was this wonderful place of diversity. There was all sorts of different kinds of Christianity. You know, everybody got to pick what books were in the Bible. Everybody got to pick what they believed. You know, did they like Paul better or Peter? There was just wonderful diversity. That's everybody's favorite word. This, by the way, is one of those areas where our culture is totally just being led around by the nose by German scholarship in the late 19th and early 20th century. There's a guy named Walter Bauer who basically wrote a huge book with this point, that the early church was such a nice place of diversity. And people today say things like this as if it's a new and cool thought, but it's essentially just letting Walter Bauer own their mind. So that's sad. Don't let Walter Bauer own your mind, I would say. By the way, Walter Bauer thought even in the New Testament this was true, that nobody really knew what the church believed because Paul had one view and Peter had another and James had another, and the New Testament itself has no one single message. So he was pretty extreme about this, and we should be aware, anybody who's going around saying, oh yeah, the early church was full of all these diverse opinions, that way of thinking, it traces back all the way back into the New Testament and really destroys our ability to believe the Bible. So it's a significant error. But anyways, in this mindset, the way that things changed was that Constantine brought in powerful bishops who stamped out diverse opinions. They brought doctrinal precision. You know, before Nicaea, people could just have a vague personal religion without all this technical terminology. And then after Nicaea, it was all about do you have the right wording? You know, it was very stern and strict doctrinally. And then there was the fixed canon of scripture that was also brought in, these people will say, by the fourth century. And as I've already indicated, this is just a massively flawed interpretation of the history. The canon of scripture was not discussed at the Council of Nicaea. It didn't even come up. There's nothing about the Council of Nicaea that's relevant to the canon of scripture, just so you know. The internet is wrong on that point. Our earliest list of the New Testament books does come from Athanasius in the 360s, but it's the same books in that list that everybody was writing about in the earlier centuries. So if you go to read the biblical commentaries that people like Irenaeus were writing in the year 150 to 180, he's writing about all the books that end up in Athanasius' list. So it's not like, I mean, you don't really need a list. You're just busy studying the Bible. And then somebody makes a list and it's the same book. So that's not that big of a change. They also didn't fundamentally change Christian doctrine. The creed that Nicaea produced was mostly just traditional creedal language. People were already familiar with it in their Sunday worship and in their church life and their baptismal discipleship and so on. The only difference was that there were particular key terms in the Nicene Creed that were meant to address the error of Arianism. So there's this famous word homoousion, of one substance, of the same substance. That term specifically was not in creeds earlier. But other than that, the idea of a creed directing our faith to the Father, the Son, and the Spirit, and covering the events of Christ's life and the doctrine of creation, you know, this was pretty much ordinary stuff, and the Nicene Creed wasn't a huge departure on that point. And another thing is that bishops did not become authoritative at the Council of Nicaea. They actually already had that way of structuring the church in the earlier centuries. They may not have been as well funded as they would become in the fourth century, but basically Cyprian in the third century, Ignatius in the second century, these were officially recognized and ordained church leaders. The church was not some kind of formless democracy in those earlier years. It had real government. And by the way, the important point here is not whether bishops or like Presbyterianism is right. That's not the question. The question is, was there formal government structure in the church? And the point is, both before and after Nicaea, yes, there was formal government structure. Nicaea didn't change that. And if anybody has this idea that the bishops were like all powerful after the Council of Nicaea, they should just read the poor bishops' writings saying, if, you know, nobody's agreeing with me, you know, you know, this is getting out of control. Like they don't write in this sort of secret police way, like, if you don't agree with me, I'll make your life very difficult. That's not the nature of the writings that you find in the fourth century. it's like really frazzled pastors saying, guys, like, you got to just go back and read the text again. I'm trying to explain to you, this is the right doctrine. You know, it's very normal pastoral leadership. And the other thing is, the other good evidence that bishops were not all powerful is that Athanasius spent 20 years in exile. I mean, he was the most powerful bishop. Officially, he was the most powerful bishop in the 4th century. Poor guy. I think he didn't realize how powerful he was because he had spent so many years in the desert running away from people. So if that's what power is like, you know, don't give it to me. So this whole idea that the 4th century began an era of compromise, I don't think is going to stand up. A final comment, heresy. Was Constantine a heretic? And I'll just say, it is true that Constantine did support the Arian side too much. I don't want to get ahead. We're going to get there in future weeks. But I'll just say simply, there was a lot going on. Athanasius was a big personality. This guy Eusebius was a big personality. Sometimes Constantine felt more friendly towards Athanasius, sometimes more towards Eusebius. And it has a lot more to do, I would say, with like personalities than it does with doctrine. The fact that Constantine, when he died, he had just been baptized by an Arian bishop. Some people really make that proof that he wasn't a sincere Christian. I would just say there was a lot of things that were very unsettled at the time, and Constantine didn't have perfect discernment. And on that we can agree. So let's conclude. Here's a sort of summary comment and a quote from a historian called Friend. W-H-C Friend. No I. F-R-E-N-D. So here's my summary. Constantine solved the crisis of the 3rd century, which even Diocletian couldn't finish. He stopped persecution. He became the first emperor to honor Christ. And these are amazing accomplishments. Here's this historian Friend describing what Constantine achieved, and he says it was a religious revolution. And here I'll read this quote because it helps you understand how big a deal this was. Traditions that had governed ideas and actions of rulers and subjects alike for hundreds, if not thousands of years, yielded to new values hitherto regarded as dangerous to the state. In their turn, these values and ideas were to endure in the Eastern Mediterranean until the fall of Constantinople in 1453, and beyond that in the Empire of the Tsars before being swept away in the cataclysm of the Russian Revolution. So if you want to measure Constantine's achievement, measure it by this. Only the Bolsheviks in the 1920s managed to overturn what he set up in the 4th century. And that's a really remarkable comment. And that leads us back to Luke 2, verse 1. Caesar Augustus said, all the oikumene, all the Roman world should be registered. It was only a few hundred years before, through Constantine, Christ's reign came to the entire Roman oikumene in return.